This is News in No Time, Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Louisiana Governor Blanco recalled, question mark, it says here, and the IRS limits the tax returns of the poor. Joining us to discuss these topics from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., where, in fact, I am today, economist and author Julianne Malveau, CEO of Last Word Productions. And in our New York bureau, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, University of Professor of Globalization and Education and co-director of Immigration Studies at NYU, that's New York University. And Robert George is also there, editorial writer of the New York Post. I thank you all for joining us. Greatly appreciate it. One of the things that we wanted to talk about, and I should note that later on in today's program, Juan Williams and our political insiders will get into the nuts and bolts of the Alito hearing and what's going on there. But we saw something very interesting. Robert George, let me start with you yesterday, and that is the toll that these hearings can take, not only on the nominee, but that person's family. We saw Mrs. Alito, who was seated behind Judge Alito, have to leave after breaking down and crying after many attacks on her husband. We heard today from Senator Joe Biden that perhaps the way we do this, these hearings perhaps are obsolete and we ought to think about a better way. His suggestion was, after vetting the nominee, just going on, letting the Senate debate it and move from there. What's your thought here when we look at what we're doing and how we do it in terms of appointing the Supreme Court nominee, Robert George?
I think Biden's idea is a very good one, actually. It's something that should be looked at. I mean, in fact, this whole kind of almost this dog and pony show of the hearings, and then the full court, the full Senate discussion and so forth. It's relatively recent. I mean, it's like maybe the 1930s, I think, late 20s, 1930s, when they started to go through this particular process. And it's just gotten uglier and uglier as we've moved into the modern day of 24/7 cables coverage and the really intense partisan divisions we've had basically over the last 20 years since the Bork hearings and so forth. And it's tough when you're obviously the person who's actually in the arena, but it's as we saw with Judge Alito's wife, it's even worse. It takes a worse toll on the families themselves.
Marcelo, one of the interesting points that has been raised over the course of the last few days, and certainly we saw it again with the Roberts confirmation hearing, is that as Robert suggests, the dog and pony show, that if you just dissect the time utilized by the nominee to answer the questions and the time used by senators to ask them, it seems as though they get, as we call it in television, as much face time as the nominee. A lot of time is spent on the senators expounding on their views and finally getting to their questions. Shouldn't we demand from the Senate a better means of actually talking with the nominees?
There seems to be an inverse relationship between time consumed by the senators and really what is at stake in terms of the outcome of this process. But this is political drama. The stakes are quite high. And, of course, we're going to see the kind of hardball play that we saw yesterday and that will continue today and moving forward. I think this captures the deep divisions that we are that we face as a nation. There's a polarized on a variety of really fundamental issues that will shape the nature of our country over the next generation or so. So on the one hand, yes, there has to be more civilized, more urbane ways of conducting the process. On the other hand, there is a need to fully air the views of the nominee. And I really do hope the senators would offer the judge plenty of time and opportunity to reveal his views before moving forward with the nomination.
Julian, what's interesting here, and Marcelo hits it on the head when he talks about the import of what is about to happen if this person ascends to the court. Yet when you juxtapose that to what we see as the questioning, it does not seem as though it would be something of that grand of a nature.
The amount of political posturing that's gone on has been excessive. I mean, when Joe Biden asks a 24-minute question to get a six-minute response, it's more about Joe Biden than it is about Sam Alito, and we have to be clear about that. At the same time, I am not even slightly moved by some woman bursting into tears because her husband is being forced to ask answer questions. If she can't take the heat, go watch it in the green room. You know, that does not move me even slightly. Even more than that, I think that what Joe Biden said this morning was interesting if the rules were changed. Ed, what I'd like to see with the Supreme Court is a 60-40 no matter what. Neither party should sway on something where somebody, this guy's 53 years old, John Roberts was 51 years old. These folks, if they live right, you know, they white, they don't eat a lot of pork, they're going to live a while. So, I mean, you know, if they live right, they're going to be there for another 30 years. And so if we're talking about 30 years of judicial input, we need to make sure that there's something bipartisan going on here. And I think that's what needs to be dealt with. Whatever the committee does at the end of the day, we want something that's 60-40. It's not about a filibuster. It's about the Supreme Court being held to a higher standard. Well, Cheryl Mills wrote an important op-ed in the New York Times last week. Sam Alito has said constantly he could separate his own views from the law. And she said, well, then the Senate Judiciary Committee ought to ask him, give me two cases where you've done that. I mean, his wife, his mama, his sister, everybody else has said he's anti-choice. So let's not talk about choice. Let's talk about other cases where you've gone on the record and said, I support private property, but because the law said this, and this is relevant in terms of Katrina, because the law said this, I went with the law. We'd like to see that from him. And I think that there has been so much on the D side and the R side, personal self-aggrandizement, that we have not heard what we need to hear from this man.
All right, and we should note Cheryl Mills is a very familiar face here in Washington in legal circles, and many people know the affiliation with the Clinton administration. Go ahead. I think, and we've got to move on, but I think somebody wanted to chime in very quickly.
I was just going to say, just in terms of the Julianne's view about a 60-40 number for passage, I mean, should be kept in mind that that John Roberts ended up, I think, with 73-74 votes in passage, and my guess is that barring some bizarre thing coming along, I think Alito is going to get well over 60 votes when the final vote is.
Marcelo, let me ask this, Marcelo, very quickly. We heard from many minority organizations about their want to really stand up and fight the Alito nomination, that we were going to hear from them, that they were going to be front and center. This was obviously before the Senate hearings opened. Are you satisfied with what you've seen since the Senate hearings have begun from these organizations? It seems to me they've been fairly quiet after the fact, and I don't know if that's because they can't get face and airtime anywhere else or whether or not they, in fact, did as much as they could do.
No, I'm not at all pleased. I believe that we haven't really had a full airing of all the issues that are implicated in this appointment. This will shape the structure of the court for really a generation, if we take a 20-year or 30-year time span. And we really haven't had an opportunity to systematically go over the basic issues that will confront the court moving forward. There has been high political drama, some histrionics, a lot of posturing, not really enough substantive debate on the issues that you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Julianne, real quick for me.
Today you will hear from some of the detractors. I don't think enough time has been given to them. But I do think that, and I don't think, you know, you have to bear in mind, Ed, you are one of a few platforms where people of color have voice. You know, MSNBC and Fox are not lining up to hear from Wade Henderson and, you know, the folks who have something to say about this. And so this really does speak to other ways that people of color don't have access in the public discourse.
All right. Let's turn our attention to New Orleans, which really has become heated over the course of the last couple of weeks as evacuees try to move back in. We have been covering the idea that there are many areas that have in fact been bulldozed already, homes that were still partially standing, and people assumed that they would be able to come in if the structure was salvageable and rebuild where their house stood before. We saw a town hall meeting yesterday that got, quite frankly, very heated, where one gentleman even said, look, if you come to try to institute this new plan that suggests that you've got to have, I believe it's 5,000 5,000 residents who come back in to rebuild the neighborhood as you know it, or in fact, the question of whether or not the city would take it over, rezone it, rebuild it. There's a question of eminent domain. A lot going on down there. A lot of pressure being put on Mayor Ray Nagin because ultimately the mayor will have to sign off on this. We see new rebuilding plans that would change the face of neighborhoods, good or bad, depending, I guess, on which side of the fence you sit, Julianne Malvo, the rebuilding plan that New Orleans is facing. And one has to believe, as we see this, along with a recall petition going up for Governor Blanco there, there is so much still going on in New Orleans. The nation has kind of turned its face away from, quite frankly, the devastation that so many people were involved in the first couple of weeks following Katrina and the subsequent storms. But the real storm, the real social and political storm is brewing right now.
You're absolutely right, Ed. I mean, it's very poignant that we sit at the cusp of Dr. King's birthday and people, you know, all these people are going to come out quoting Dr. King for the next 2 weeks. But he died in the middle of a poor people's campaign. And that, by and large, is who has been peripheralized here in New Orleans. Of course, there are some middle-income areas where people have also been disadvantaged. But if you're a property owner with insurance, I won't say you're okay, but you're better off than if you are a renter in the Ninth Ward. And this is what's being dealt with. Mayor Nagin from Front Street was schizophrenic and confused, and it's real clear. You know, he couldn't tell you where he was going to be on any given day. He had a group of business people who were saying to him, we want to change the demographic of New Orleans. Let's just go back to September or to August 28th, 27th. New Orleans had 487,000 people. Two-thirds of them were African-American. Today, there are fewer than 200,000 people there. Probably 70% of them are white. How do you begin to restore the demographic? Is that your goal? Where do these crazy proposals for light rail come at the same time that you're talking about eminent domain with people's property? The people who were angry had every right to be angry. Many of them were unrepresented. And Ed, in fairness, we would have to say that other people who were part of the Rebuild New Orleans Commission were driving in from Houston or Dallas every time this group met because they had been themselves displaced. Mm-hmm. And so you have this, you're juggling something that's crazy. But the whole principle and issue of economic justice and fairness is not there. And here's the biggest problem. Who is profiting from this? And we know that people are. And some of those profit takers need to put those profits back and make sure that people who've lost what they built for their whole life, they've lost everything they ever had, are now just being flung into the winds, and that's how it is.
Marcelo, here's another interesting portion of this case, and that is the idea that, in fact, eminent domain, which has been looked upon as something that is growing in this country. I mean, we saw the story, and I think it was Connecticut most recently,
Connecticut,
the question of whether or not properties can be seized. Oftentimes, nothing more than to build a strip mall where developers have decided that that's the best place for it. When we see this as a test case, even with the extenuating circumstances, we can see the tentacles that reach from New Orleans and the different areas that are most prominent and prevalent in today's headlines.
Yes, this is really a social trauma of biblical proportions. We've seen the exodus of a people in the context of this natural disaster. And now what we see is, in a way, the outsourcing of responsibility to the citizens, to the victims. When we are presented this formula whereby communities will be rebuilt as a function of the proportion of citizens that would return to the various neighborhoods. Look, what we have to build in New Orleans is basic trust in the community, basic trust in the political leadership, basic trust in the structures of government that will make the rebuilding of the city necessary. Without that sense of collective ownership for the future of the city, we will continue to see these half-baked ideas that are very unlikely to produce the kind of massive rebuilding that will be needed if this city will come back to its past grandeur.
Robert George, can we find that basic trust that Marcello talks about when you have, as Julianne said, those who see this as a profiting opportunity and all efforts by many to see this simply as an opportunity to grow their own pockets? When you see the political wherewithal and machinery moving in to try to see this as an opportunity to displace a Democratic governor with the possibility of, as Julianne put it, the changing demographic of New Orleans that could have been easily Democratic and now portions of the state because of the large population of New Orleans to Louisiana, now an opportunity for Republicans who are now mounting, as I said earlier, a recall campaign against the governor as an opportunity for a political movement.
Okay, well, I think the short answer to that long question was no. you can't really. It's very difficult to build those bonds of trust. And the fact is, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, and so there will be people coming in to try and profit from it on a monetary sense, and there will also be people trying to profit from it politically. However, I think we also have to just look at things in a pragmatic sort of way in terms of human nature. And while I think it is true that there are some legitimate justice issues that Julianne raised, you also have to think of, though, what are the poor people of New Orleans, what are they doing right now, the ones that have ended up going to Houston and have been displaced elsewhere? In many cases, a lot of these people are moving on with their lives, and they have made their own kind of personal decision about not moving back to New Orleans, and they've decided to, you know, go west or, you know, go where opportunity takes them. So I think in that context, well, I think it's a tragedy that New Orleans, as we've known it, has been permanently changed. I don't think we can automatically just kind of drag these people back just for our own personal kind of idealized way of what we would like to see New Orleans become.
All right.
Some of these people are homeowners. That's the thing. I mean, some of these people are homeowners, and their wealth, the accumulation of their wealth, has been snatched from them.
All right.
And we have to deal with that.
All right. But let me say this. Some of these, just to make sure that we understand, when you talk about they moved on with their lives, many of them have simply moved. They've not moved on with their lives. They haven't found jobs in these new places. They haven't found places to stay. They're getting ready to face being displaced yet once again. So I think it's important that we keep the light shining not only on New Orleans, but in the places where these evacuees find themselves. Robert George, Marcello Suarez Orozco, and Julianne Malveaux, thank you very much for joining us today. Greatly appreciated.